Welcome to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, I, David Schleicher, and my co-host, Sam Moyne, talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our mind. We're really glad you're here with us today. We have a really fun episode today where we're once every season, we bring on a well-known journalist to talk to us. So who do we have with us today, Sam?
It's Osita Nwanavu, who is just a stellar journalist writing a book. He previews it for us, and we cover, you know, the state of media and writing, and then turn to the Republicans and the Democrats and where they are leading us.
It's a really fun conversation. So with that, let's get to it.
Well, this is exciting. Our guest today is Osita Nwanavu, who is has not been known to me for very long as an obsessive, you know, monitor of mainstream media and alternative media and Twitter. But he's been one of the most insightful voices, you know, who's emerged in the past five or so years. And it's our privilege to have him on our podcast. He's been writing for the New Republic. He worked at the New Yorker before that, and he's recently started a regular column at The Guardian while also writing a book on American democracy called The Right of the People. He has a website, ositanwanavu.ghost.io, where you can sign up to his newsletter, as I have, and we're eager to get into it. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to just begin by asking how you've, you know, thought about, you know, your career in this very confusing media environment as a young person. You know, we have some law students who listen to this podcast, but some might be aspiring writers. I know at least one of the two hosts is, and it would be great to just begin with, you know, how you have built the career you have.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm at a place now in my career where people are starting to ask me to talk to students about how to make careers in journalism, and like, what did you do and what were the pathways that you took to enter the industry? And the weird thing about it is that when I was in their shoes and trying to figure out how to build a career in writing, you know, you'd go to sessions that would be run by some group on campus where they'd bring in like a newspaper journalist or a television journalist or somebody who'd been in journalism for a long time. And they tell you, you know, back in my day, I was just sort of the cub reporter at the local whatever Gazette. And then, you know, gradually doing that over a bunch of years, I got picked up by the New York Times. And that's sort of how you build out a career. And I thought to myself, okay, well, those papers don't exist anymore. You know, I'm not, you know, I'm reading a lot of blogs and reading a lot of stuff online. And it didn't really seem to me that there were enough people doing the kind of writing that I'm doing now, where you could have somebody come in and say, this is how you sort of make it in. I think I'm in a generation of writers where the new thing is like we've spent our entire careers within the online journalism world. And so to be in a position where you're now telling people for the first time, like this is how you do that is still kind of strange to me. So the short version of how I made it in is basically, you know, I went to UChicago. I did a lot of writing on campus, not for the campus paper, The Maroon, but for this paper called the Southside Weekly, which covered politics, art, and culture just on the south side of Chicago. In general, got a lot of my early clips doing that. It was my first time really reporting or writing about politics. I'd have opinions that I'd share on social media, but the first formal writing that I did was for That Alt Weekly. You know, did internships at NPR and Slate and a couple of places locally in these times. It's a progressive magazine. It's really great on the north side of Chicago there. There's a semester or two where I was an intern at the Chicago Reader. But eventually I sort of found my way to the world of magazines proper. So I did an internship at Harper's Magazine that I thought was really helpful and informative and trained me to do certain things. You know, by the time that I graduated in 2016, I'd had a previous internship at Slate, and they were happy to have me back as an editorial assistant. After a while of doing that, I was taken on as an actual staff writer, went from there to The New Yorker, was there at The New Yorker for a year, and then came to TNR. And that's really, I mean, I've jumped around a lot, even though I've only been this for kind of a short while overall. But yeah, it was just a matter of, you know, hard work is part of it. But honestly, I think people in this industry have to be candid to people who want to come in, that a lot of it is about being at the right place in the right time, not just in the luck sense, but in the sense that I went to an elite college, in the sense that I grew up in Northern Virginia. And so when I would come home from college to do internships in DC, I just have a place to stay with my parents. And a lot of people can't do that, or, you know, can't afford housing in some of these cities. This industry is still concentrated in two of the most expensive cities in the country. So, you know, I think that is also part of why I've had the chances that I've been given. I don't know. I'm just trying to work as hard as I can. And
no, I mean, that's all really helpful. I mean, you seem, though, as well to be, you know, caring a lot about writerly craft, as well as, you know, facing a certain media moment. And, you know, one thing I looked at in reminding myself of some of your great pieces is this Columbia Journalism Review piece. And it seems like it's partly a protest against the hot take industrial complex, to which, you know, everyone on Twitter and, you know, many journalists or most are led. But you also have, you know, you make an argument, as I read it, that's especially about a generation of kind of progressive journalists that are spending a lot of their time, as you see it, preaching to the converted, and then, you know, then gets blindsided when some of the views turn out to be unpopular. So I guess I get that diagnosis, and we're going to get to popularism later, which is, I think, a very different thing. But it's sort of, I guess I wasn't totally clear what you would like to see in the alternative and what you're actually doing. So, I mean, there's longer exploratory, thoughtful stuff that would be better. But it's, there seems to be this really kind of hard fact that we have an animated left today, but the center keeps winning. And that's like, that is that kind of our situation right now at or yours as a writer? And is there something you can do about that? Or is it more like this is the time, you know, in which you've been given a shot?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think the question, the political question and the sort of the question about writing craft are related, but I think I want to take on them separately just to sort of keep them clear in my own head. So as far as the craft of writing and the kind of writing that you're able to do right now within the online, or even just sort of the general writing economy, the piece that I did for the Columbia Journalism Review was a kind of an attempt to think through some of the limitations that I've encountered in trying to write about politics today, particularly from a left perspective. I really do get the sense that, and this isn't just true in political writing, just sort of across culture writing, across the spectrum, you are driven to certain ideas and certain ways of expressing those ideas by algorithms, by certain sort of commercial incentives, you know. And particularly if you're a political writer, you have to find ways, if you are at a publication that is a sort of general interest publication that's intending to have a broad audience, you have to find ways to make radical or counterintuitive, sort of non-obvious opinions. You have to find a way to have those meet the algorithms, or have those meet the imperatives that your editors are trying to, you know, meet, and your publisher, or the owner of your magazine, whatever it might be. You have to make everything kind of align in a way that's often difficult. And I think one of the ways I've confronted that problem is just sort of by writing less, you know? So now I'm in a place where I'm not writing regularly for TNR anymore. I'm still contributing there, but I felt that some of the ideas that I was trying to wrap my arms around, which is kind of too large for, you know, too large to squeeze into the news cycle, or and sort of too large to broach in the kind of writing that I'd been doing on a regular basis. And so that's why I took on this book project. But that's not to say that I don't think there are people who are working within the standard forms of political media and trying to do something new with them. So I think that the model for me of somebody who is capable of doing regular writing that's accessible to a large audience and intended for a large audience, but also, you know, is trying to push them in new directions. It's trying to draw from academia. It's trying to draw from history. That person is Jamelle Bouie for me, is one exemplar. His columns at the Times have been really, really terrific. There was, I think, a point a couple of months ago where he put out a piece and sort of joke tweeted, you know, I'm going to stop. At some point, I'm going to just sort of abandon any pretense that I'm trying to meet the news cycle or something to that effect. Because it was something that was sort of just based, it was a take on American history and trying to bring that history to the fore in ways that aren't just about what people are mad about, you know, on a given day. It was just sort of, this is a large idea that you can extract from this historical event. And I thought that was great. And I think he does that on a regular basis really, really well and impressively. So, you know, I think it's possible to do the political column well. I just think it's really hard. Most of the people who are employed doing that work don't do it very well. But so the political question, you know, this sense that the left has all of this energy, a lot of smart people writing, talking, bringing new ideas to the front, but still losing. What do you do with that as a journalist? You know, I think that you have to present your ideas in a way that they catch fire or sort of broadly appealing to people who aren't already subscribers to Jacobin, you know? And I think that's sort of the particular challenge I've taken on with this book. Like, there's a version of the arguments that I want to present that is just sort of very intuitive and easy, and that's, you know, people who are already, people who know who I am and people who read the same things that I read will find, you know, just sort of obvious. But I really want to reach the person who watches Rachel Maddow and to get them to think more radically about what democracy is and what it can mean and the fact that we don't have democracy at work. Like, that's, if I can do that, that's the success of the book. I don't know that you really move the needle by convincing leftists, you know. You're not really convincing, just sort of telling leftists that the American political system is messed up. Yeah, it's true. But you need to convince somebody who has really internalized everything that they heard in Miss Whoever's civics class in seventh grade about how wonderful the Senate is and how well-balanced everything is. Like, that's the person you need to push in order to... Yeah, exactly. That's the person you need to actually push if anything's going to change. So, you know, I think that there are things that are constraining about writing for a general audience and writing for a major publication that's trying to reach a general audience. But also, you should be trying to make use of those channels when you can. And if you find those particular limits constraining and you want to work outside of those publications, you still have the obligation of writing in such a way that you're reaching as broad a potential readership as you can.
That hit my, where I was questioning about the same essay, which was that Ford essay that's talking about the constraints on writers, it doesn't actually put the readers particularly centrally to the story and what they want. And so one of the things that, like, it's like pretty, in a lot of the research on, like, say, bias in the media, is the publication Left Wing or Right Wing, is that it mostly just reflects its readers' politics, right? So, like, a newspaper in a conservative area will use more conservative language or language associated with political conservatives much more than one in a liberal place, simply because people want to be told they're correct and spoken to in the language they want. And the internet is kind of maybe like the best machine we've ever created. Not just the algorithm, it's that the consumers of news no longer have to get their vegetables in order to find out the score of the game or to see classified ads or whatever it is that they otherwise would like to do. And I'm wondering, like, the question of, like, it seems to me that, like, getting people interested, forgetting the politics bit for a minute, but the interested in longer form journalism is, like, an effort at getting people to eat their vegetables. Is that like the right metaphor to use here? Because it does seem that most people just don't want to, most people don't consume political news. And if they do consume political news, what they want is to be told their preconceptions are correct. And therefore, your job on some fundamental level is to give the people what they want. And that you're rebelling against the strictures of your job in the sense that you are being a less commercially a success, like a, or alternately, your job is to convince them that really roasted broccoli is delicious. Is that like, I mean, I couldn't tell whether that's where you're going, but the explaining the algorithm seems like a mistake. It's like the algorithm is reflecting the consumers who have a desire for certain things and not other things.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that there are baseline desires and the consumer will gravitate to a certain kind of writing. But I also think that consumers can be sort of nudged in new directions and that there is a greater capacity for the ordinary person to absorb challenging ideas than they're often given credit for. That's just sort of how I feel. I don't know if other people feel the same way, but I've just been encouraged by the extent to which, you know, I'll write a piece that's, you know, long, and it's like thousands of words long. It's not like the standard length of a political essay that does well and gains traction. But I'll hear from, you know, people who aren't necessarily plugged into politics Twitter, and they'll say, well, you know, our article really made me think about politics in a little bit of a different way. One of the most rewarding experiences I've had in journalism thus far was, I think, in the weeks, I think just before and just after the 2020 election, when I was invited to come on to a podcast run by a Twitch streamer, a guy who plays video games, just sort of on Twitch for people, but also talks about politics. I was invited there to sort of come and talk about my writing and things I've been, you know, thinking about and democracy and all of these kinds of things. And, you know, I think that for most people who are in this industry, you think about that audience and say, well, those people aren't politicos. They're not really capable of absorbing like large ideas about what democracy means. And that they don't want to hear you talk about James Madison or whatever. At the end of it, I got a ton of messages saying, you know, this is writing. These are ideas that really spoke to me. I hadn't really been somebody who paid a lot of attention to politics or thought really deeply about politics. But, you know, there's something about this or that essay, this or that piece that really help me understand what's going on. I was really a heartwarming thing to read. I mean, these are people who aren't very engaged deeply, but you know, I think that we make a mistake by writing off, not just in politics, but just sort of in American culture. We make this mistake, I think, of thinking that because people read a certain kind of political writing, they read a certain kind of book, or they watch a certain kind of movie, and that's sort of what they kind of naturally gravitate to, that that's all they're capable of absorbing. And that you're going to have a real time getting people to sort of challenge their own preconceptions or challenge the kinds of content that they're willing to engage. I think that people have much more of a capacity to absorb things that are difficult and not obvious than we give them credit for.
I guess the question is, capacity versus desire, right? So like, it's like, I mean, going on Twitch and talk and tricking, it's like, that's almost like a, it's like there's a, what's that? Jerry Seinfeld's wife used to make recipe book where she would make desserts that were like one third spinach. I feel like that was the trick you're just describing. Is that, I digress. Sam had a question.
No, I mean, I don't know if it was a trick. I mean, look, like I don't think any of us wants to spend all of our time thinking about talking about politics. Like it's like vegetables for all of us, right? Like, but you know, if a desire to engage deeply with politics doesn't necessarily come naturally to people, that still doesn't sort of eliminate all obligation as writers or journalists or people who care about changing things in the world to really try to reach people and to make those ideas more accessible. I mean, you know, I mean, it's not going to be as fun as watching television or, you know, playing a video game, whatever. But I don't know. I think that that's just sort of thing you have to accept and deal with. And you should be encouraged by the fact that if you make the effort to make your ideas accessible, and you make an effort to reach out to these kinds of communities that aren't really deeply engaged in politics, you'll find some receptivity. And, you know, if they're not as fully plugged in as you are, that's just sort of a fact of life. But that doesn't mean that you can't reach them in ways that are going to have some kind of positive effect on their understanding of politics and on the on their communities and our country.
Well, I appreciate your optimism, and I just assume that, you know, writing, teaching is an act of faith where we assume that it's in some sense worthwhile, rather than just like a massive self-confirmation machine. But there's still, you know, there are still like the kind of structural constraints, and I'm just, you know, one more round on kind of media today before we move on to kind of the Republicans. You know, I just, it's shifted a lot, but it still seems there are some limits. So let me just explain. When I was your age, there was center left media, and I'm sure there was, you know, another venue, but I didn't know about it. Whereas now, as you mentioned, there's Jacobin, there's N+1, there are Substacks, you know, TNR, which was at the absolute dead center of center left media, you know, has become something radically different in our time. And yet in the end, if you want to write a book or you want to, you know, speak through the, you know, the New Yorker or the Atlantic, it just seemed that you mentioned before, you know, editors want what they want. And the kind of institutions of legacy media, which, you know, you're still participating in, and book publishing, it has a certain tilt. And do you think that that's kind of still an opportunity that you can kind of shift it a little? And like every so often, you know, the New Yorker publishes something edgy, or is it more that, you know, these are institutions that we have to get beyond somehow?
It would be great if we could get beyond them. I don't know how exactly. Media takes money. Reaching large audiences takes money. I mean, this is also the political problem too that the left kind of faces. I mean, you want to build out political institutions, organizations that exist outside the Democratic Party, hypothetically. Okay, well, who funds them? Like, one thing that the Democratic Party has as a leg up over potentially rival institutions is that they have money. They have rich people who are willing to bankroll their political project because it aligns with their interests, right? And so if you want to build out an alternative media, you know, you can crowdfund. There are different, like you said, there are different publications cropping up all the time now. Will that sphere get to a point where it rivals the reach that the New York Times has or the Atlantic has? I genuinely don't know. And I think that there are probably structural constraints that bar that. Certainly, I don't imagine a left-wing television network that can rival the reach of a CNN or an MSNBC or a Fox, you know. So, you know, I think that you kind of have to hope that that sphere keeps enlarging, but also, you know, again, trying to see the extent to which you can smuggle in more radical ways of thinking into these legacy institutions. And if you can't do them directly at the institution, then at least write in a way and present your ideas in a way that people who are used to the ideas that are being presented by legacy institutions aren't scared off by what you're trying to say.
So I think the presumption you guys just laid out is all wrong. And I'm just kind of curious about it, which is that, so like one thing that shows up in one of your pieces Biden is allied with the centrists type politics and that the left doesn't win, and therefore critiquing left critique, this move you make in a couple of your pieces, and it's a totally sensible one. But one of the really notable stories of the last, say, 10 to 15 years is how much the center itself has moved, right? So it still exists in relation to some other politics, but like, it's like, I mean, I don't know, the New York Times published the 1619 Project, like, 15 seconds ago, and it's literally supposed to be the most state institution in the world. And like, it's a, the the idea that, like, get beyond these institutions is these institutions, like political parties, are up for contestation. And I, you know, like, I don't share a lot of your ideological priors, but it seems to me that, like, one of the things that makes American political institutions, both political parties and things like the New York Times, particularly notable is exactly how open to contestation they are and how radically they move across the political spectrum. Again, not necessarily in relation to other institutions so much as, like, from where they were. Like, what is centrist liberalism looks nothing like in the White House or in the New York Times, like what it looked like 15 years ago. And therefore the contestation is like, that's where the action is. Like, what's happening in Jacobin just seems like completely irrelevant relative to like what the New York Times, which is now this colossus striding over online media. And so, like, or media broadly, or alternately the same thing is going on the right also in mirror institutions. Like, it's like what happens at Fox is where the action is. And like, right. And so this is like, why get beyond them? You fight for them. And that's just what you see in primaries and political parties. It's also true for like in any of them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I disagree with you. I mean, I think that's kind of what I'm saying, in the sense that, so the movement we've seen in the Democratic Party on a range of issues over the last decade or so, I think has been partially, really, like, you can even say largely a consequence of writers, more progressive activists, academics finding forums in the New York Times or near publications like Vox and reaching audiences of sort of influential liberals and changing the way they think. You see that especially on racial issues, for instance. You talked about the 1619 Project. There's been a huge shift in sort of the understanding of white Democrats across this country about white supremacy and sort of the racial history of this country. But I think the point I'm making is that those ideas aren't new. You know, people have talked about reparations for generations now in all kinds of outlets. To your point, it was a particular set of essays or a particular writer at a very mainstream publication, The Atlantic, that I think probably deserves most of the credit for advancing that conversation in public discourse and sort of really deserves a lot of credit for the racial shift in general. I don't know. I think that to have outlets that are not just venues for your ideas, but actually dedicated to a particular political project, that have a cohesive vision of politics that they want to advance and mobilize people around, I think is important for a political movement, right? So conservatives didn't just content themselves with having columns at major publications, right? They built out their own magazines. They built out, they tried to build out their own television network. They've even built out their own colleges, right? That generates, build out, you know, activist networks and that they use to develop leaders in their movement, right? So I think that if you're somebody who's functionally an ideologue like I am, you know, it's important to do both things at the same time. So you want to have access to those legacy institutions because they're able to broaden the reach of your ideas, but you also want to have institutions that are dedicated to your mission, if only because that's where the ideas come from in the first place, and that's where you sort of test things out with your ideological peers, and you have these arguments, and at a certain point, something becomes ready to present to the wider public. I think that's how a lot of political thought tends to work, you know. The New York Times, I don't know if it's going to be a venue for robust debate amongst different left-wing writers about sort of factional tendencies. You need a place to do that stuff too. And so to that extent, I think that having the outside institutions is important. But I don't think that, as I was saying before, you're ever going to get to a place where those outside institutions replace the legacy institutions and are also things that ordinary people read. I just don't think that's in the cards. You have to sort of do this inside-outside game.
Okay, so let's shift from, let's say, form to substance and first talk about the Republicans a bit. And I just wanted to begin with, you know, your take on January 6th. You had an excellent piece in, this time in the, you know, New York Times, you know, as a so-called guest essay. And I wanted to, you know, give you an opportunity to lay out your case there. I mean, as I see it, there's been this kind of unhelpful dichotomy between those who think about January 6th by, you know, essentially, you know, defending institutions and then, you know, claiming there was an armed insurrection against them on the one hand, and then those saying that institutions are the problem, and yet they tend to then minimize actually the whole significance of January 6th, or saying it was a pathetic flash mob or whatever. And it seemed like you were in a sense cutting through the dichotomy in, you know, saying January 6th was produced by institutions. So is that the correct rendition? And, you know, is that what you still think?
It is. I mean, I don't think that institutions are the only reason why January 6th happened or why Trump happened. I think it's more complicated than that. But I do think that the role our political institutions have played in not just, you know, the specific events of January 6th, but the rightward turn or shift of the Republican Party in general, the rise of Donald Trump, the role of institutions have played in all of that, I think, has been underexamined. Certainly within, again, if you want to talk about it, again, these legacy institutions that are very worried about creeping authoritarianism, you know, racial populism, all of the bad things people are quaking their boots about. I think that there's been a real desire to locate the sources of those things everywhere but the actual design of the American political system. And, you know, I found that frustrating for a long time. Like it is actually relevant that, the bulk of the American electorate did not support Donald Trump in 2016. Like that's not just a kind of liberal talking point. Like I think that's critical to understand how, somebody like him, how, you know, the politics of racial resentment can achieve, meaningful political power, even if it turns off and alienates most Americans. I think that's a critical thing to understand. I think it's critical to understand that Republicans probably face a less significant penalty for going to the extremes than a Democrat might, just because the design of our political system advantages politicians, parties that have real appeal to rural Americans and exurban Americans, and penalizes politicians that appeal more to urban Americans. Like that's going to shape political incentives in ways that are probably going to influence the extremism that we've seen over the last 5-10 years in American politics. So I thought all of that stuff was worth bringing out, and it's one of the things that has animated this book project, this sense that a lot of the ills that we ascribe to particular people in American politics, particular bad actors, are actually being, if not fully generated, certainly being reinforced by institutional factors that nobody really seems to care about.
So maybe this is a question about the book that we haven't yet seen, of course, because it's not written as I understand it, but it's one of the things I found interesting or troubling, I'm not sure which, about the column was its lack of any comparative perspective. Because the idea, like kind of the both kind of like populism with some kind of like democracy skepticism, whether it wins or loses, is not, surely not an American phenomenon in any meaningful sense, right? So yellow vests, Viktor Orban, right? You can go, it's true across, it's a set of ideas that's crossed the West. And so whether it wins is obviously affected by political institution, and the form it takes is certainly affected by political institution. And I don't say this as any brief for American political institutions. In many ways, it's like the fact that it reflected in winning is, you know, a reason to condemn. And certainly you're not going to find a bigger Jonathan Rodden stand than me on the rule, the importance of districts in determining political outcomes. But in terms of explaining the kind of ideological source or even the existence of kind of populist, I guess, anti-democratic sentiment, it seems like this, you need some story that is not rooted in American institutions simply because other countries don't have American institutions, and yet they have things that are very similar in ideological structure and in tactic, right? So like there are truckers going on Ottawa right now. Like it's a, you know, that's a, it's like similar in style in a lot of ways, if not in content and kind of outcome.
Sure. I think, again, I don't think it makes sense to say that Trump or January 6th is exclusively the product of American institutions. There are a bunch of other factors that feed in. But one thing that you really sort of appreciate when you read a lot of current democratic theory is that for a lot of political scientists, political philosophers who are trying to tease out the locus of authoritarianism, not just here, but abroad, there's the sort of general sense that democracy, as it's been constructed, not just in a country like the United States, but as it's sort of been broadly constructed in the West, is not equipped to solve the problems that people expect it to solve. Even though there are different institutional forms, the United States does not have the same institutions that France does. France does not have the same institutions that Britain does. There's a kind of broad dissatisfaction with the way putatively democratic institutions are working that demands a rethinking of what democracy ought to look like and how it ought to be designed. People like Helene Landemore, you know, wrote Open Democracies, offered a set of different models that she thinks are applicable to all kinds of putative democracies that are not being fully democratic from her perspective. So like there's a sense in which there is a broad democratic crisis across the world that demands that we sort of reinvestigate democracy's first principles and rethink how institutions, broadly speaking, are working. I think that American political institutions have political particular problems that have you know, fed into a particular political situation in this country, similar to the situation that we're facing other countries. But you know, there might be some common thread in the lack of representativeness or the extent of to which people are being driven to extremes by their frustration with the absence of political outcomes that they expect from political systems, you know. So does that make sense? Like it's certainly not the case that America is the only place where you're seeing a rise in authoritarian populism, but some of the commonality there might be the fact that we have democratic institutions that people are coming to feel aren't really acceptable or accessible to the public. We certainly have an economy that's basically everywhere. You know, we have social democracies in Europe, but basically everywhere, you have very minimal rights to sort of assert your will or have your say represented within the confines of a particular corporation. They have, you know, power that transcends, national boundaries, and they're becoming institutions that are deeply relevant to democratic questions that aren't really being addressed anywhere, even in Europe. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of reason to think that institutional factors are playing into the rise of right-wing authoritarian politics, even though some countries have, from my perspective, better political systems than the United States, or more equitable political systems in the United States. There's still something in democratic institutions I think is worth investigating to see if it's actually meeting the expectations people have of how government should work.
Okay, so let me try to make sure I get the basic story, and it's kind of just getting at your theory of the right. So, I mean, one way of taking the institution story is by saying, you know, the Senate, et cetera, privilege, you know, some atavistic actors and keep the rest of us, the majority, from reinventing democracy along the lines that you know, were just suggesting in the face of these common problems that, of course, have a local inflection everywhere. Another view would be, you know, the right is also in protest against these blockages and dysfunctions. And, you know, it's unclear to me, you know, is that your view? And how does that story go? Because, you know, we're talking about, I mean, a party that has a certain characteristics that, you know, the RNC announced that January 6th was legitimate political discourse, which, you know, is in a certain way like a weird concession to like the norms of like debating and talking. But then there are 85 million people that voted for Donald Trump after he'd been vilified for 4 years by The Atlantic et al. So I'm just trying to get your read on the right. Is it a kind of minority we have to, in a sense, overcome because they're not willing to reinvent the institutions and have get kind of a more genuine democracy, you know, along a lens lines or some others? Or is it kind of a symptom or actually seeing things about dysfunction that, you know, we need to take seriously?
My general sense on the right is that, one of the last pieces, I think the last piece that I wrote as a staff writer at the New Republic was called The End of American Politics, which is intentionally provocative. But the point I was trying to make there is that you have institutional thinking both on the left and on the right right now. So people like me will talk your ear off, as I just kind of did, about political institutions and the extent to which they frustrate what you know, the popular will and blah, 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 blah. I think on the right, there is also a kind of sense now that there are institutions or entities within American life that are not accessible to them. You have all of this conversation now about woke capital, you know, people making cultural decisions that they feel are foisted upon the good Christian, you know, conservative public. And the difference there is that the right's frustrations, I think, are not really solvable within the confines of democratic politics as we understand them. Like, you cannot legislate your way to transgender people not existing. You know, like, that's not, there are certain cultural problems that are not solvable through politics, but it still generates this sense of frustration that democratic contestation is not going to get them the goods. We believe it on the left because we think the political forms are bad. They believe it on the right just because I think that they see that there are actors that operate outside of politics that can find them and that they can't really do anything about. I mean, the thing that's weird for me in trying to understand them is that I think that they've gotten to that place partially because all of the things that you would want to achieve through a conventional political avenues, whatever you want to call it, in conservative politics, the confining, constraining of the American welfare state, deregulation, the decimation of unions, et cetera. A lot of that work has been done, frankly, at the national level, certainly the state level where conservatives control government. And so there's this, you know, absence of that kind of an agenda. I'm not saying that there aren't things that conservative policy won't still want to do, but there's, at least from a left perspective, maybe this is blinkered, there have been a lot of victories on that front, and the victories that have been sustained even through democratic administrations to some extent. I mean, Biden spent a lot, and I hope he spends more, but, you know, Democrats are working within these boundaries that have been set by the last 40 years of American politics. And there's then the question of, like, what do you do next? I saw this morning that somebody's just written about the Heritage Foundation, you know, and the shifts there from talking about tax policy, whatever, to talking about critical race theory, you know. But that's sort of why we think about the right. I think that the right is in this place where there's a lot of frustration, there's a lot of anger, and there's also a sense of political powerlessness, because they're confronting a set of problems that politics cannot fundamentally address in the way that they'd like it to be addressed. And a lot of the problems that they see are sociocultural. And that, again, seems to be a common thread that you can draw between conservatives here, conservatives in Europe. You know, immigration is one place where there are potentially policy solutions from their perspective. And, you know, there are issues like that. But I think that there's sort of just broad cultural malaise that's taken a foot. Or it's taken a hold of the right just about all over the place.
Okay, so let's shift, you know, in the end to the left then, you know, because some of your best and most caustic pieces have been kind of about intra-liberal or intra-left dispute about kind of programmatic alternatives to the right. And, you know, I appreciate that you say Joe Biden has done a lot or more than expected or whatever, but you know, you've been central to a kind of, you know, dispute about whether there are cleavages between so-called reactionary liberals, as you call them in one great piece, and, you know, other liberals or the left. It's, you know, I'd love to hear if you're saying you're a liberal or a liberal socialist. And you've also kind of, at least on Twitter and some other places, you know, engaged a lot in the kind of popularism debate. And so I just want to get a sense of, you know, as of today, is it basically a kind of class and identity politics going together, you know, repudiating those on the left who insist on returning to a kind of responsible, vital center? And, you know, does that come with costs, you know, electorally or ideologically or otherwise? I mean, I have a sense of that I've got your views, but I just want to give you an opportunity to kind of give us your sense of how you're coming out today.
How to solve the left?
Yeah.
As a problem. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I kind of think that substantively, you can't really separate out class, quote unquote, class issues or core economic issues from questions of identity. I just don't think it's substantively possible. And even to the extent that you try to do that in political rhetoric, voters are not stupid. Like, you know, just because you're not happening to talk about African-American issues as a Democrat or transgender issues as a Democrat, I think that there's still a sense in which voters will still look at you and say, well, that person is for trans rights, and that person's for more immigration, that person's for investing in African-American communities. Like, that's the story of the Democratic Party for me. Like, it's a lot of people making efforts to put all of the identity politics behind a curtain and hoping nobody else notices that that's what's there. And some people do better at that than others, but it's a strategy that's been less and less successful over time. I think that's partially because parties in general are more ideologically coherent than they used to be and more ideologically legible than they used to be. You have these national media environments where even if you're not talking about a particular issue, somebody is going to run a segment on national television about somebody saying that you should abolish the police in New York City. You know, like there are just certain factors that make it very hard for you to separate out those issues, even if you want to and you try really hard to. Barack Obama tried extremely hard to over the course of his presidency. It was criticized by a lot of African-American academics, activists, for the way that he would talk about race. I don't know that there has been a president since Abraham Lincoln who spoke as eloquently about American promise and the American dream and working your way up and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. People still thought he was a Muslim. I mean, you know, I think that there's a level of delusion in these conversations about what sort of tricks of political messaging and rhetoric can actually achieve. That doesn't really leave you with very much of a solution. I've said in the pieces where I've confronted this, it's not like the left has a lot of grand proven ideas either on how to win rural Americans. Like, it's, you know, that's still a work in progress. But the extent that people tell themselves the answer is reviving Clintonism, which was itself like only kind of dubiously successful. I mean, Clinton's first midterms were a disaster. Clinton was seen, you know, by a lot of people as this weird, not fully patriotic culture warrior. People talked about the 60s during his presidency. You know, the idea that you can sort of get yourself to a neutral politics where people just sort of confront the core economic questions and the pocketbook issues and leave everything else by the wayside is just not how politics work. And I think people are wrong when they insist that that's how politics work, whether they're on the left or writing for The Atlantic. I just think that's misguided. The challenge of presenting the alternative is something that I think the left should take up. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to ask about this because it struck me that you're, I wonder, like, kind of situating your critique of popularism and David Shore-ism in light of some of the political science work. And so I'm just kind of curious what you think about this. So one of the big ideas in the study of political parties in the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years is called the UCLA School of Parties, which is usually popularly like the Who Decides book and shadow primaries and that stuff, right? And so the idea of it is I'm just saying now for our listeners and everything, is that like political parties are really run by their interest groups. That rather than thinking of them as vote maximizers constrained by primaries, we should think of them as a kind of a coalition of interest groups, particularly true for Democrats, that is constrained somewhat weakly by electoral concerns. And I think one way to look at what the popularists are saying is an ineffectual talk, saying Joe Biden talk about elections in a different way. But a more reasonable way is saying that they're talking to the genuine powers who are the groups themselves who dominate Democratic politics. You could do the same thing in the Republicans, but yeah, and saying, hey, look, what you want is largely bad. Like the electoral constraint is sharper than you think. And therefore, rather than thinking of their like it being a mistake that they are they've convinced Joe, the Biden administration, or whatever, but like who they're talking to or who they should be talking to, if they're not, I don't know, is the purveyors of the kind of intense policy demanders on the left. How writers fit into this, I'm not 100% sure, but it's the debate is like who, like it's like if you imagine that there's a contestation over control of the broader party agenda in both parties, now if we're talking about Democrats, then like the question of how electoralism fits into this is a way of saying like you can affect what the party does, what the politicians do, not that the politician in charge, you're in charge, and you should think about this more directly. Do you find that version of the argument more or less attractive?
I mean, I think it's undeniable that parties are functionally coalitions of different interest groups. I think that just a view of how they work that makes a lot of sense to me. I think what I say to that and what I say in the popularism piece is it's actually pretty hard to detach political messaging from what interest groups want and to sort of corral them in the way that I think that Shore envisions. If you told somebody that on a substantive basis, I mean, the Republicans don't need to do this strategically, and this is one of the major differences between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. But if someone went around saying, you know, I'd really like to get the Republican Party to listen less to the NRA or listen less to the pro-life groups, and politicians should sort of try to minimize the extent to which those groups influence Republican Party politics and discourse, that'd be a really hard project. Because those groups fund a lot of money to Republican politics. They are the source of a lot of Republican activists. A lot of Republican primary voters invested in those specific issues. I think the Democratic politics works in a similar way. Like, I think it would be genuinely very hard to say, well, we're just not going to listen to the immigration groups on this or that, and we're just going to sort of ignore them and pretend that they don't exist and try not to have them shape our discourse as much. I don't think we should pay attention to the groups that are talking about voter suppression in Georgia. You know, like I just think, you know, it might be more strategically necessary for the Democratic Party. That doesn't make it easier. And I think that there's a kind of fallacy where you think that sometimes because something needs to happen, in order for you to succeed. It must be a way for it to happen that's it's within kind of reach. I mean, you know, I just.
But doesn't that fit your fatalism pretty well, actually? Which is that, like, if the story is like, in fact, it's the institutions that mean the Democrats lose something, like, you know, like districts and Senate and what have you, then like a diagnosis of what they could do if they could corral themselves or get it together or whatever else. See, and then you're saying, in fact, no, that's not actually possible because like they are rowdier than that or less controllable than that. It's like saying you can only win if you get an inside straight, but you can't to get an inside straight. So you're just going to lose.
I mean, yeah. And beyond the groups, I mean, I think that in 2020, I think it was in 2020, like 50% of Democrats or some the largest number ever recorded of Democrats self-described as liberal, right? There's just been a tremendous amount of growth in the extent to which Democratic primary voters think of themselves as progressives. So what do you do with that? I mean, that's a force that shapes the way you talk about politics, because you need to win a primary in order to get to the point where you're contesting an election against a Republican in the first place. Those are the people who are going to be donating the most. Those are people who are going to volunteer for your campaign. So, you know, I just think that there's, I don't know, a level of, I don't even know what to call it. Just a detachment from certain hard realities that's being promoted by people who present themselves as the realists. I think it is just, there's something fantastical about telling yourself you can detach rhetoric from these constraints and have that rhetoric purely on the basis of the cleverness of your messaging, you know, reshape the American political dynamic in your favor. It's not something we've seen succeed before. Even under Clinton, again, like Democrats worked very hard to minimize the salience of racial issues. And you still had, you know, the head of Congressional Black Caucus going to the Million Man March with Louis Farrakhan. Like there's a limit to the extent to which you can control the constituents of a party apparatus, especially within a party that is as diverse and heterogeneous as the Democratic Party. And I just think that's a limit that Democratic strategists have to contend with.
Okay, so this has been great, but in a kind of crass genuflection to the fact that this is theoretically a legal podcast, I'm going to ask a last question about the Constitution, which you hate. You have a great, you know, scorching piece, "The Constitution is the Crisis." And, you know, you're part of a movement, which I think is incredibly salutary beyond, as you put it earlier, civics class, where we pathologize the, you know, the sacred text. And I just want to, you know, get at your sense of like, how big a part of the crisis is it? I mean, it sets up certain institutions. But there's a lot of other things going on. And those institutions are functioning a certain way in light of polarization and, you know, class politics and, you know, media transformation. Is there like a legal project that you're calling for that is about the Constitution, or is it just like one other thing in the kind of search for the Holy Grail on the left?
Yeah, oh, I'm certainly not a legal scholar. So, you know, the extent that I've written about the Constitution, I've really drawn from the work of a lot of other writers and people who write about the founding as legal historians, people who sort of assess its current day, the problems with the current day constitutional order. So, you know, I feel kind of like, I don't know, like, do I have the right to say that this is, there's a specific legal project that we should embark on that's going to fix everything? I don't know that I feel comfortable saying that. What I can say is that I think the Constitution should be open to discussion in the way that it hasn't been. We don't have conversations in this country about what democracy means, what democracy is all about fundamentally. We have conversations about what is constitutional, what the founders intended, right? But there's a conversation you can have behind all of that, which is, you know, why do we think that people should rule? And what does it mean for the people to rule? How do you institutionalize that within the system? And then you can start to ask yourself, okay, how well does the Constitution align with those principles? That's, I think, the set of questions that I hope that people in the legal profession encourage people to start asking themselves. I'm not somebody who thinks that there should be a constitutional convention next year or even 5 years from now. I think that the project of moving to a different kind of political system is probably a century or more long project, but it's never going to get off the ground unless we tell ourselves that the Constitution is a legal document that was forged under certain conditions, that was designed to meet certain, to align with certain certain incentives that obtained in 1787, and the among the actors who are privileged enough to be in Philadelphia, you know, for that convention. Like it's a product of a particular time and particular set of political constraints and economic constraints. And there's no reason why we should believe all these years later that we have to be bound to it functionally for all time. It just doesn't make any sense to me, especially given the radicalism of the founding as an act in the first place. And in fact, the Constitution, as Sanford Levinson points out, was our second one, right? Like the Articles of Confederation came first. They thought it wasn't getting the job done. They thought it would have certain intrinsic flaws. And not long after, they'd come up with it. They came up with something else without going through the process of amendment that the Articles of Confederation had laid out. You know, I think that we should tell ourselves we have the same right, prerogative, whatever you want to call it, to rethink our institutions on the fundamental level. And I just think that there should be a lot of debate, discussion, and experimentation as we try to figure out what an alternative order might look like. So I guess that's a kind of a long, windy answer to your question. Again, I don't think that our institutions are the only problem that we have as a country. But I do think that all of the other problems we face are difficult to address democratically through the system that we have. As a practical matter, I actually don't think that we should sort of tell ourselves, well, we're only going to be able to do something about inequality once we fix the Constitution. Like, that's just not, I don't think that's where we think about it. But, you know, it is. I think true that if we wanted to have a well-functioning democratic politics that was routinely, regularly responsive to the problems that emerge in a society as large and complex as we are, we would need to create a different political system at some point in the future. And I think in the course of doing that, we can begin to answer some of the other questions that are facing us as a country about inequality and some other things. That's a very long wanted to answer again. It'll hopefully be better in the book. But one thing I will say too is that part of the book is not just about the extent to which our institutions are anti-democratic, but also, and I mentioned this before, the extent to which we have an economy where individual people are dominated. People don't have the right to make decisions. Decisions are made by authorities that, you know, are seated well above the public. You know, the decisions are being made at the top of the company you work for are often affect you more directly than decisions that are being made in Washington. And every time democratic theorists seem to confront that question, with very few exceptions, they'll sort of shove it into like the last 50 pages of whatever book and say, well, you know, we should think about the extent to which democracy applies to our economy, but that's beyond the purview of this conversation. I don't think that you can meaningfully talk about rebuilding a democratic order without addressing economic questions. The reason why we have the Constitution we have, again, is partially because there was a certain class of people who got to make the decisions. They were afraid of certain things happening at the level of state governments. They thought the Constitution could be designed in such a way that it prevents, I think, what Hamilton called the depredations that the public is want to make on property or something, in a quote to that effect. You have to talk about the economy too. And I'll spend a good portion of the book doing that. And I think that's part of the book is motivated towards getting people to think ambitiously about democracy in that way.
Well, we're looking forward to it, honestly, and I'm sure many listeners will be eager to see it out in the world and for this, you know, taste of what's going to be in it and a review of some of the highlights of your writing in recent years. We're really grateful that you could join us. So, Osita Nwanavu, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you.